lecture four. And before I get going, in this lecture we'll finish off part two, is the plan. And that shouldn't be too difficult. The first half of this is going to be a bit more of a route march through notation, I'm afraid. The second half should be more examples and should be a little bit more conceptual. So brace yourself for the first half, but it should be over soon. Before I get going, I was mentioning a couple of things on the Moodle. One of which is that, that microphone's on. I'm pressing a button called mute, mic mute, okay. One thing is that on the Moodle page there is a link to, I can't get to that page from here. Anyway, a couple of changes of things. As I mentioned in the message I sent via Moodle, there is a podcast of the audio recordings of the lectures which should be findable at the end of the link that was in that Moodle message. So that is a bit of an experiment, both pedagogically and technically, so any comments or thoughts with that, I am very keen to hear them. Other things that are here are... there's lecture audio podcast, but we can't get there from this computer. That thing there, all notes with HTML, that's a bundle of the entire collection of notes formatted as HTML. It's sort of readable and might be useful in some circumstances. It's a lot less pretty than the PDF version, but it might be of some interest. The Padlet I'll mention in a moment. Now, the stream channel, which, let's not worry about that, which I think I pointed to you before, it has a couple of things. It will have the brief, so 5-minute overviews of the various parts will appear there. Part two is there, part three will appear, part four will appear. Also, as of 10 minutes ago, it has copies of the first couple of my lectures from autumn 2020. So they're the recordings of the Zoom lectures, the first ones I did. So they're a little bit ropey. I thought I was in two minds about putting those up I'll put them up. The deduction is not that that these lectures are not important. I'll put them up with a bit of a delay in any case, but they are an extra resource to use as you think appropriate. You're all have honed your learning strategies over the years, and I'm sure you'll be sensible about the use of them and imaginative. So I will put them up there, put these two-year-old lectures up as in time. I will point you again to the lecture notes folder in the Moodle, which has the notes and the screen versions and the slides of the parts that I've completed. So after today, I'll put up the part two slides PDF. There's nothing in the slides, as you're aware, that isn't in the notes, apart from the sort of answers to the quick questions things, but they will appear there in good time. I think I'm up to date there. Regarding the Padlet, I see there are some good questions there, a couple of which I think I've answered. As I say, if you think I haven't answered that, then change the colour back to white and I'll see it again. I've just answered two there. I've released the solutions, a compendium version of all the solutions and a compendium of notes on the solutions. I'll release that either at the end of this semester or the beginning of the next one, so it's a good time for revision, but it appears after the lectures and some of the slides. I answered these two questions, as I say, change the colour back to white if you think that's, if you disagree. I haven't had a look at these, although I could do a quick look at this one. Someone asking, I'll post a note on this, is there any significance to this order being swapped? No. And there isn't, because the metric is a symmetric tensor. So in general, these two things would be importantly different. Because the metric is, by hypothesis, a symmetric tensor, it doesn't matter. Okay, so the question was, why is the basis vector being dropped in the first place here and the second place here? There's no significance to that. Okay, it just I changed my mind in the two cases, and it doesn't matter because G is symmetric. So I'll make a note of that later, and I'll get around to this point in a moment. Right, we shall proceed. Are there any questions about either what I've said there or about burning questions which haven't been in the Padlet about what we covered last time? No. Good. Okay. So, the plan now is for me to get rid of this and get these up again. I think we've got to about there, didn't we? Yes, we've got to about there. So right, we've got to the end of section 226. So, what we discussed last time then was your first look at the rather fiddly technology of components and all the things, the algebra you can now do with the components of tensors and one-forms. And now we're going to go on to the important question of, last time I talked about the... We talked repeatedly about basis vectors and the basis one forms that were dual to them. But there's nothing special about any basis that we pick. And that's the that goes back to the principle of covariance that I mentioned in the first lecture. What that principle is the statement that there's nothing special about any basis that you pick. There's nothing special about this initial frame or that one or any other. What that means in turn is that if you change your mind about what is a good basis set of basis vectors or correspondingly good set of basis one forms, then you have to be able to go from one basis set to another. And that's what we're going to talk about in the first half, I hope, of this lecture. So what that means is a bit more notation, and what's the best way of writing this? I'll leave that up there. Near projector, document camera, turn that on. Okay. So we have a basis, a vector A. Is the light annoying? Can you read that okay? Okay, which we're going to write as AIEI, with, as I said before, the implied sum over the dummy index I. And the components there are just the set of numbers which you get when you apply the vector A, regarded as a function, to the one form. One of the basis one forms. Okay. Now let's change our mind about what the basis vectors are. And rather than the basis vectors E, I, we'll instead have the basis vectors E, I, bar. Now that looks a completely demented notation, not least because it's slightly fiddly to write. What I've done is I put a... I'm putting a bar over the index here. Now there are other ways of writing. There are notational alternatives here, and different books sometimes use different things. Some use a prime, some use a hat, but the general consensus is that the indication goes over the index and not over, as you might expect, over the basis vector itself. So we don't write E primed I, for example. We don't write that, although that might be what you might first guess. And the reason for this will, I hope, become slightly clear. So that means that just as we can write A in terms of the basis vector EI. We can also write it in terms of the basis vectors AI bar, EI bar, where there's a, again, an applied sum over the dummy index I bar. Okay? So that's just as good our basis set as before, and just as before, the components AI bar are the vector A applied to omega I bar, where the omega I bar is the set of basis one forms dual to the basis vectors EI bar. Okay? So all I've done there is notation. I'm just saying that this is what a change in your mind looks like in this notation. Now, again, so this is the component of the vector in the alternative basis. But we can expand A however we like. We can, for example, write A is AI EI omega I bar. I think that light is annoying. I'll see if it might not be possible, however. Is that important, do you think? I don't think it's possible to make that as visible. What I could do is put it on that other one. That's probably smarter. I can probably do both. Far document camera. Should be legible somewhere. Aha, right, that's the problem. There's light. Okay, we'll just have to deal with it. So, we don't know what that is. We can't just decide what that basis vector applied to that basis one form is. So we'll say instead that it's some set of numbers, lambda I bar I. And that lambda, which is a matrix, is a collection of numbers, of n by n numbers. That matrix lambda is what characterizes the relationship between one basis and the other. And it is just this basis vectors EI applied to the basis one form EI bar. Okay? So that's your transformation matrix that takes you from one basis to the other. So that is probably not a... This is a long way to something that you possibly have thought of before in other contexts. We've written the matrix at that. In the same way, the components of a one form P will be P applied to E I bar. Again, we can write P is equal to P I omega I E I bar, which is equal to lambda I bar P I. And you can see this all sort of works in terms of the summation convention, because the pattern of raise and lower indexes hangs together, and we end up with as here, one I bar on the bottom, and a pair of raised and lowered I's on the right hand side. So I will go. I sort of want to say, have a look through these notes yourself. Indecision. Yeah, but let's go through this stuff. I'm slightly nervous here because it's always very easy to get these indexes wrong when so doing this, as it were, live in front of people. But the next step is to let's do it that way. We want to look at the. What's the best way of doing this? I don't want to make this too complicated, but I don't want to make it trivial. Let's write down this omega I E J, which is the, so. This is the basis one form. This is happening just in one frame, and we'll write that down as delta I J. So I'm two minds about going through this step by step. I think I will because it's useful as an illustration of the handle turning of the relevant algebra. So we have an expression like that, but we can also write each of those. What I've written down here is just the thing we decided on last time, that the basis one forms are going to be dual to the basis vectors in this very specific sense, that omega 1 applied to E1 is 1, omega 1 applied to any other basis vector is 0. So that's all that we're saying there. That's the definition of dualness. We'll then write down these two things in terms of the expressions we have here. That's lambda I bar omega I bar, right, lambda J bar J E J bar. I can't obviously write I bar I here because I've already used up I already in the sum, so I've got to pick another dummy index. Tensor application is linear in its argument, so we can take that lambda out, get lambda I bar lambda J bar J omega I bar E J bar, but we are also going to presume that in the change basis the basis one forms I bar are also dual to the basis vectors in that basis, so that will be lambda I bar lambda J bar J delta I bar J bar. And we do that sum, you end up with lambda I bar I lambda I bar J, which is the unit, the identity matrix. So remember, delta is the components of the matrix with all ones on the diagonal, which is telling you that lambda I bar a lambda I bar I are matrix inverses. So this is an example. I think I earlier said that if you look at the components of a tensor, then they are always representable as a matrix. So you, just because you've got an array of n by n by whatever numbers. But the converse is not true. This is an example. Lambda is an example of an array of numbers, a matrix, which does not have a corresponding tensor. Because there isn't a geometrical object which those lambdas are the components of. Okay, that's a key thing. So the matrix of components of, or the vector of the column of components of a vector or a one form, or the matrix of components of a tensor, are not just a random matrix. They are linked to the geometrical object, a single geometrical object, which is frame independent. Okay? But lambda is not a tensor. And that's why, just parenthetically, we write the indexes just one above the other. If you remember, when we write the matrix, the components of a second rank tensor, we carefully stagger them because they're referring to different arguments of the tensor. In this case, this isn't a tensor, There's no need to stagger the indexes, and we write them one above the other. And in this, for something like that, you can sort of start to see why the bar goes over the index rather than the vector, because it lets us keep track of which way round or which way up, if you like, the matrix lambda is. And that which you couldn't do if the notation were elsewhere. No question.
Sorry, is that J bar on the second term?
This should be I bar J bar J. This one. That's I bar I bar J, because we have summed over the J bar. So that is, if we do the sum over J bar, this term here will be zero, except where J bar is equal to I bar. So the only term that survives out of that sum is the term where J bar is equal to I bar. So that's how we get that. Thank you. Yeah. So part of the point of me writing this out longhand is to go through exactly the step by step quite slowly. So yes, we are doing that sum over J bar, and that's why that delta there changes that J bar into an I bar. So we're left with a sum I bar I. Due to me indexes, we're left with a raised I, a lowered J, just as a raised I, lowered J. So everything matches, okay? If the indexes you've got on one side don't match the indexes you've got on the other side, you've done it wrong, okay? It's not clear what you've done wrong, but you've done something wrong. So that's always a check. You can be at every step through this calculation, we could check: does the have one raised, one lowered J, duplicated I bar, duplicated J bar? That's good. That line's good, and so on. So you can check each line against that with that sanity check. And there's right and. I'm not going to go back and forth through the notes, but by going through a similar sort of calculation, you can discover that this lambda matrix, this transformation matrix, doesn't just transform components; it also ends up being how you turn one basis into another. And omega I bar is equal to lambda I bar I. Now, you may think, oh my God, that's an awful lot of things to memorize. You really don't need to memorize anything, because once you've got the idea that there's an E, a lambda, and an E, there's only one way the indexes can go. So you don't have to memorize this. You just have to know that the general idea and the indexes fit in only one way. So there's no memorization here. But there's a useful exercise. It might be one of the exercise 214 to 217, which invites you to form a table of these things. It's not a terribly exciting exercise, but it helps you just drill that a little bit more, so that is useful. And this sort of thing also is why I think it's useful to use bars rather than hats or primes, because it's just slightly easier to write them neatly, I find, rather than having dashes or circumflexes or all over the place. And when later on we start introducing punctuation to this notation, things would get a bit hairy unless you'll only end up with very neat handwriting at the end of this course. Well, you'll have very neat handwriting of a few letters. Your Q's might look terrible, but your I's, J's, and K's will be perfect. And these are both generalizable, it turns out, so that something like T, I bar, J bar, K bar is equal to lambda I bar I, lambda J bar J, lambda K bar T IJK. And again, I didn't have to memorize anything there. I just remembered the pattern. There's one lambda per index, and there's only one way that the indexes fit in. Boom. There's a few other remarks which at the end of that section, which I don't think it's useful to belabor. But in the last half hour, I will move on a bit. But first, what questions have you about that? A question there in the middle. Here.
No,
here. Yes, because that's a very good point. That's useful to highlight that these, because they're matrices, and because that's just a matrix of numbers, these are all numbers. They're all things on the real line, so you can swap them about all you like, and because the sum. So one of the advantages of this component notation is that it means you can swap things arbitrarily because they're just numbers, and numbers commute. So when we later come on to talk about differentiating things, differential operators don't commute with numbers, but numbers do. So is that what you meant? Yeah. So yes, you could if you wanted to write those in another order. Weird, but you're allowed. Okay. Your question there? Indeed, absolutely. So I could, if I wanted to really confuse myself, write lambda I bar k lambda j bar m bar lambda k bar m lambda J bar equals T K M J or something. Now that would be perverse, but there's nothing stopping me doing that because all that I've done there is I've changed my mind about the dummy indexes. To a stupid thing, but an allowable thing. Okay. So I've just to check one dummy yes. So I've still got a I bar J bar. Sorry, I've given myself too much leeway. So sorry, that should be a J bar, and that has to be a K bar. So there's a matching I bar J bar K bar, but K M and J in this case are dummy indexes. So disappear.
So if we swap the first with I, J's and K's,
yeah.
If we swap the lambda in second position, then we would have to put K bar as an higher index.
So if we swap those two, you mean?
Yeah.
The sum would be okay. Let's write that down in that case, just show it. So if we wrote lambda j bar j lambda I bar I lambda k k bar t I j k, that's what you mean, yeah. Again, it's still just a sum over I j. And K, and because they're just numbers, each element in that sum, all that will have happened in this quite long sum that is an n by n by n sum, is that the real numbers in the product of each of those terms will be in a different order, which is the same. So yes, these lambdas are just numbers. Right. Right. In both these cases, this is this appears to be a 2-1 tensor. There's a tensor which takes. I've just picked a rank, to illustrate this. So it's a 2-1 tensor, so there will be two raised and one lowered indexes. But once you've got, and it's a, if it's a 2-1 tensor here, it's the same 2-1 tensor here, it'll have the same pattern of indexes. And once we've got that pattern, then the pattern of lambdas inside in the transformation follow.
So the last line, the right, it is last line below. So it is a 2-1 tensor.
Yes, it's still a 2-1 tensor. Yes, the two up and one down.
Up and one down.
Yeah.
Do you have to swap all three, or can you just swap I bar to I and then just leave J bar and J bar?
Yes, you would have to, because the what this set of numbers is the components of that tensor in that transformed basis. So in each so it is so T I J I bar J bar K bar is equal to T omega I bar omega J bar E K bar, and so it wouldn't make any sense really if you were to drop in one form and vectors from two different bases, then you get a number, but it wouldn't mean anything.
They are just the different forms of the tensor to write down.
These.
So this is one form, and the below is another form.
So this tensor here is a 2-1 tensor.
Yes, it's a 2-1 tensor. So it's the same with the lambda I, the same with.
Yes, it's the same tensor.
It's just the two form.
It's the same tensor.
It's the same tensor.
Yeah. So they're really all different forms of the same tensor. Okay, and one better move on. But the one last question there.
On the bottom right, you've got three lambda.
Yep.
And then you said that equals a tensor.
It equals the components of a tensor. Yeah.
Sorry, what?
It equals the components of a tensor. Yes.
Oh, okay.
So each of these is a matrix. That's a matrix which is the matrix of components of a tensor. And similarly, that's a matrix which is the components of a tensor.
Okay.
So this is a one tensor is equal to n by n by n terms, which are a number times the components of a tensor.
Okay.
Is that what you were asking?
On the next bit, you just got the three lambdas.
Oh, so that's not supposed to be there. Is it? So they're not supposed to be an equal sign there. Well spotted. Well, someone is paying close attention. Okay. That is the all of the components all the component gymnastics that we were introducing. So the last bit is slightly less algebra heavy, and just a few more examples of bases and transformations and spaces. So the first example of a space in which we can talk about these things is flat Cartesian space. Now it's flat in the sense that, I think, do I define that here? I think we'll come back to flat in a moment. You're familiar with flat Cartesian space, flat Euclidean space. You're familiar with flat Euclidean space with a Cartesian basis. So Euclidean space is the space we're familiar with, where Pythagoras' theorem works. The Cartesian basis is the x and y basis. So things are given, the basis vectors are orthogonal to each other. Though we and the unit length. Although, right now, up to the point where we define a metric on that space, we can't talk about length or about angles, but you have a metric in your head. Pythagoras' theorem is the definition of a metric. It's how you turn directions into distances. In flat Cartesian space, we have EX1, EY equals E2. And this is a good point to say that I will sometimes swap between numbering the basis vectors and giving them, you know, a slightly more mnemonic symbols there. We can sort of sum over these things, we can't sum over these, but if we're referring to specific things, it's useful to write things like that. So our vector in flat Euclidean space, or in any thing, A1, E1 plus A2, E2, and which we can say it right as AX, EX. This is a slightly informal notation. And that's something you learned about in secondary school. So that's, you know, there's nothing exotic there. So this is a very long way to come back to something you learned about in school. But there's nothing extra at this point. So what are the one forms in this space? Well, there's no, as we said earlier, there's no constraint about what the one forms are. But we can choose them so that they contract to form the Dirac delta function. So the basis one form number one contracted with basis vector one is one, and is zero contracted with other ones. And what do the components of that look like? They look exactly the same as the vectors. So in flat Euclidean space, the one forms, when you turn the handle and find what they look like, look exactly like the vectors. You can't tell them apart. And that is why you never had to learn about them before. Because in a sense, you've always been dealing with one forms in flat Euclidean space, but you didn't know it because they looked indistinguishable from vectors. So if you want to think about it that way, you could say that row vectors, in the example I used earlier, are the one forms of flat Euclidean space. So you'd be using them all the time, but you never had to care. Similarly, if you sort of continue mechanics in previous years, you learned about the inertia tensor or the strain tensor. You never had to worry about raised and lowered indexes because they didn't matter. There's no difference between the raised and lowered indexes, if you like, in Euclidean space. The components of the one are the same. The transformation between them is just the Dirac delta rather than anything more complicated. Not the Dirac delta, the Kronecker delta. Okay, mustn't get bogged down. And our metric in this space is just G as the components, Gij equals that's here. There's no sums and no implied summations here. Our metric in for this space is just 1001, if you like, which ends up with when we apply that to a vector, we get Gij Aij, picking up what we did last time. And if we do those sums, I equals 1, I equals 2, and so on, we get A1, A1 plus A2, A2, which is equal to A1 squared plus A2 squared, which is Pythagoras' theorem. So deciding that this is our, defining our metric this way is equivalent to saying that Pythagoras' theorem works. And the length squared of this vector A is just its x component squared plus its y component squared. It's this fact that means that when you raise the index or lower the indexes of a vector in this space, what you get is the same number. In other words, vectors and one forms have equal components in the space. The other points are I'll go through the polar coordinates bit fairly quickly, just because I want just to I'll draw your attention to that section. It is the same set of ideas, but with another case that you're familiar with, polar coordinates, but which is slightly less trivial than the Euclidean space with Cartesian coordinates. And you can again discover what the components of this transformation matrix. We might even have that in our. I'll go through this quickly. So the basis vectors of polar coordinates are just a transformation away from the basis vectors of Cartesian coordinates. So we're saying E1 and E2 are the x and y basis vectors that you're familiar with. The basis vector in polar coordinates is that fairly obvious transformation away from that. The basis vector, the tangential one, is a similar one. Now, that R there is not what you've seen before. Usually, when you've seen this transformation written down before, implicitly, they're scaled so that R is not there. That is what makes the one you're more familiar with, the basis vectors for polar coordinates, it makes them unit vectors. So these are not unit vectors, but these are natural in a different sense. So that's not a typo. That is the sort of natural thing in this context. I'm not going to go into that. But the point is that here, this is a concrete example of a change of basis. And boom, 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 boom are the components of the lambda matrix, the transformation matrix lambda. So that's just the transformation matrix lambda applied to the pair of basis vectors E1 and E2. I'll let you go through that section slightly more slowly in a moment. And we can point out that I'll let you look at that after I put the slides up in a moment. The metric of polar coordinates G is equal to 100 R squared, which I mentioned just to show that it's not the diagonal unit matrix of the metric of in Cartesian coordinates. That's all in the notes. So I'm going to skip over. I'm going to skip over section 233 because although it's not false, it's potentially a little confusing, and go to another very important special example where the Minkowski space, where the metric, and you do the traditional thing of writing the components in Minkowski space with Greek letters, and the metric is also traditionally referred to as eta rather than g, is the diagonal matrix S1, 1, 1, 1. Eta here is a matrix with particular constant components. They're not the components of a tensor. The vectors in this space are A equals to A mu E mu, and we can write the the metric applied to two vectors G A B with G mu nu A mu B nu, which will be equal to mu B mu, which will be equal to minus, oh, thank you, A 0 B 0 plus A 1 B 1 plus A 2 B 2 plus A 3 B 3, where I am sticking with the convention that in Minkowski space, the basis vectors are numbered 0, 1, 2, 3. The indexes, Greek indexes, run over 0, 1, 2, 3, and it's a four-dimensional space. And so what we have got there is the inner product in Minkowski space, the inner product of special relativity, that you may recall from the last time that you studied special relativity. So this is a prompt, a hint, to perhaps drift back to those notes from 2 years ago and remind yourself a little bit of what was there. A question.
Why are you using a different
metric than in because it's arbitrary. Why? In second year, we used a metric which was plus, minus, minus, minus. And if you to make that the signature, that means the signature of 1 plus minus 1 minus 1 minus 1 minus 2, the signature for Minkowski space will always be either minus 2 or plus 2, depending on your convention. And a number of other equations you change in turn. Now, I prefer, when talking about special relativity, to use the signature minus 2, because then the interval is the same as proper time. It is more conventional in GR to use the signature the opposite way around, so that the spatial sector has the plus 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 sign. And that's really just a matter of taste to some extent, a sort of taste and tradition in a way. So it would be perfectly reasonable to introduce special relativity with that metric, but it is arbitrary which way around it goes, nothing changes. So in 30 seconds, I have a question there, yes?
Sorry, what is the same for the minus 1, 1, 1?
Diagonal. So that's the expression for diag 1, 1, 1. So it's a matrix which is zero except along that diagonal. Okay, and blah, blah, blah. And the transformation matrix, which takes you from one basis vector, but set of basis vectors in Minkowski space to another basis vector, set of basis vectors in Minkowski space, is this transformation matrix here, which you may be familiar with as Lorentz transformation. So all the Lorentz transformation is just how you get from one basis set attached to the station platform to another basis set attached to a moving train. That's what a Lorentz transformation is. It's a change of basis. And the point of a lot of special relativity and GR is that the physics doesn't change when you do that. And that, in fairly decent time, is us. There's a few extra remarks in section 2.4. We're talking about coordinates and bases, and just clear up a bit of bits of terminology. It'd be good to have a look at that section just to get your head straight around those. But that's us done with part two. So we'll go on to part three next time, which is next Wednesday. I will see you then.